You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 21st of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly dose of cultural opinion here on Monocle 24, broadcasting from Studio One at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
And coming up on today's programme, we'll have a final look at the films to see or perhaps avoid over the festive weeks.
He wasn't necessarily in good shape and he had this comb over that was rather elaborate. He had this confidence that drew me to him.
We'll be reviewing American Hustle, among other releases. We'll also be asking our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, Joseph Dana, what's on his reading list.
These two books are kind of personal reflections from completely different vantage points on where Israel's headed, how did the Palestinians play into that picture, and whether or not we're actually at a turning point in the debate.
And for all those about to embark on some last-minute Christmas shopping, we'll be here to give you some inspiration.
We're all about the analog. We're not about the computer games and stuff. So, a nice wooden skittle set. You can enjoy that with the kids, the nieces, the nephews.
Yeah, it's sort of family fun.
Plus, a roundup of some of the year's best releases for this week's music segment and a guide to the cultural calendar of Buenos Aires. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. So it is just a few days before Christmas, Gillian DeBias. You have our cultural look ahead this week will have a sort of a festive feeling to it, which is, you know, for very clear reasons. But you're going away for your New Year festivities, aren't you?
Well, I am, and it's part holiday. But so I have a lovely wintry cold Christmas in London, and then I'll be opening the suitcase and putting warm summer clothes in there because I'm going to Cape Town first, a week's holiday, and then that will evolve into a week's work filming because 2014 marks the launch of Cape Town 2014 World Design Capital.
Which looks astonishing. I mean, it is what, just over a year since it was announced. Do you think Cape Town will be able to make its mark in terms of design?
Well, completely, because, I mean, we've had Turin, Seoul, Helsinki, and those have been kind of about design, objects, furniture. This is very, very different. For the first time, it's really about design as problem solving and looking more at the city. And it's really about taking Cape Town, the canvas of Cape Town, and using design to solve social, economic problems. And not just for Cape Town, but using Cape Town as inspiration for other cities for the future. So
it's also one of those great things that Cape Town can do in an awful lot. You said just not just for Cape Town itself, but for the rest of the continent, because South Africa and the whole of Africa at the moment is one of those such a fast moving place that one clever design could really transform the lives of a very large number of people.
And it's about ideas and ideas that work. And when you have a whole year like this, so you've 12 months to blue sky, you know, that you have really people thinking about issues, inviting people from all over the world. So I will be making a film on that. So.
My cultural week was no watching. Well, quite a lot of watching, but a little bit of participating as well. I've been doing the carol services, ladies and gentlemen. It's been great. It's been really, really nice. I'm not really one for carol services, but somehow I've managed to get to three this week, which is what stopped me from going to anything else, really. Everything would just happen to be standing in a church singing. And I was just examining the etiquette of the carol service. There was one carol service I went to which mixed traditional carols with an organ, and then there was a little bit of a country and western, "Oh Come All You Faithful," when someone stood up with a guitar, and they were pleasing too many people.
I don't like it when people mess around with traditions.
No, including the tradition of everyone singing the wrong descant to "Oh Come All You Faithful" at the end. Let's look at some film. So with just 4 days to Christmas, the prospect of ever making it into a cinema again seems rather distant. But think ahead, ladies and gentlemen, to beyond the next few days. And for many, there could be a few lazy days and evenings to fill.
And we are here to the rescue to help decide what films to see over the festive period. Here's film critic and friend Tim Robey. So here we have, you know, it's this luxury period when you, if you're lucky enough, you have 2 weeks to just look at your dance card, as it were, in terms of films and pick what you really want to see. What's top of your list?
Well, I've seen a lot of these things. I mean, there's loads out. On Boxing Day, for instance, All Is Lost, the Robert Redford film, is up, which is very interesting. It's Robert Redford is the only person on screen in this film.
Right.
And it's a sort of a shipwreck drama in which he wakes up on his yacht to find that the hull has been kind of perforated and water's seeping in, and he's sort of screwed unless he figures out a really, really kind of clever and hasty way to repair his ship. He's going to drown. And at 77 years old, this is Robert Redford carrying the film totally single-handedly, and I think it's really good.
It's an astonishingly strong idea. It requires a very strong actor to do it, and Robert Redford arguably is good enough to do it. I mean, can he carry? How long is this film? I mean, he doesn't talk very much at all, does he?
There's very little dialogue. I mean, he there's a bit of voiceover at the beginning. He kind of explains the situation. And there's one extremely memorable word that he shouts quite late on in the action when things aren't going so well. You can probably guess what word that might be. But beyond that, he is really just, it's almost like you're sensing this conversation he's having with himself without him ever speaking a word. He's sort of like, how am I going to sort this out? What do I do now? Oh no, now this has happened. Now I've got no water. I'm totally starving. I'm miles from anywhere. And you can sense all of these dilemmas going on in his head. Very, very good performance.
It sort of reminds me of The Life of Pi with the shipwreck. But there you had the fantasy and the animation. I worry, when I looked at the trailer, I worry this would be just torture, just going through disaster after disaster.
I mean, it's so pared down to sort of the basics. I mean, the character doesn't even have a name until the end credits come up. And this is one of the errors in the film, I think. They list him as our man, which is a bit sort of like Hemingway or something. He's sort of like, oh, he speaks for us all. But the film itself, until that point, doesn't do any of that. It's very, very specific and detailed about the kind of crisis he's got himself into.
I think we have a clip of this. Although there's no dialogue, we'll have to bear with us. It might sound a little wet.
This is Virginia Jean with an SOS call. Over. This is the Virginia Jean with an SOS call. Over.
A little clip of All Is Lost, an absolute tour de force by Robert Redford there. Tim Robey, as Gillian mentioned a little earlier ago, when you look at what he goes through, does it actually get too much? Do you ever actually want to break the fourth wall and walk out? There are some films which are purposefully unbearable. Is this one of them?
I know what you mean. And in fact, if we compare Gravity, which is not a dissimilar film, you know, Sandra Bullock stuck in space, what's she going to do? Gravity has to resort to sentimentality, really, to kind of get us through it. So she has the kind of dead child that we learn about.
The red shoe under the table.
Yes. I mean, it's all a bit much. Here, you can see the temptation to go there. And there's a bit where there's this instrument he brings out to try and help him. And it's a gift from someone. There's a card inside it. And he looks at it and he thinks, no, I'm not going to open this card because it will actually, it will destabilize me and I'll kind of give, emotions will take over. So he actually closes it and puts it away. So you can sort of, the film is sort of saying, we don't need this. We're just dealing with the kind of pragmatic minutiae of how he's going to get out of this scrape. I mean, he's 77 years old, Robert Redford. I think he's tremendous in this, but he's actually, for such a major movie star, he's in some ways quite an underrated one. He's only been Oscar nominated once in his career for acting, which was for The Sting in 1973.
But that's probably because he decided to focus his energies on doing an independent film.
Absolutely,
first of all, and directing.
Yeah.
I think if he really, really wanted to be a continuing screen star, he probably could.
That is true, and he's given terrific performances over the years, but they've often been very understated. I think here he will actually get another Oscar nomination. This is his sort of comeback moment as a movie star, and it's fully deserved, I think.
A Christmassy question. If you are heading out into the cinema, what kind of feeling do you leave the cinema with? Because that's very important on at Christmas. You want to kind of feel happy.
Well, that would be probably spoiling the ending. Am I going to call it inspiring or deeply tragic? You're going to have to go and see. I mean,
fine. Yeah. Lovely. You talked about a very pared down film, All Is Lost, there with Robert Redford. Let's go to something a little less pared down. American Hustle.
Well, this is sort of the opposite of pared down. This is a massive starry extravaganza. It's directed by David O. Russell, and it's the third film in what he has called his sort of unofficial comeback trilogy, because he made The Fighter a few years ago and then Silver Linings Playbook. And this film basically cobbles together all the actors from those two films and puts them in sort of 70s wigs and flares and terrible comb-overs and gets them to kind of reenact this true-life saga of kind of conning and connivance and financial fraud. And it's, so you've got Christian Bale, you've got Bradley Cooper, you've got Amy Adams, you've got Jennifer Lawrence, And you've got Jeremy Renner as well, who's actually the newcomer to the David O. Russell repertory company.
I'm curious to hear what this sounds like. So let's have a listen.
He wasn't necessarily in good shape, and he had this comb over that was rather elaborate. He had this confidence that drew me to him.
My father, he taught me to believe that all people are good and to be good to all people.
Life is ridiculous. And you know that I would never say anything bad about your father in front of you, but your father is a sick son of a bitch.
Daddy's a sick son of a bitch?
Don't repeat that. But yes, we gotta get over on all these guys.
It's gotta be the best we've ever done.
A little clip there of American Hustle. Tim Robey, there are the two main male characters in this. One actor I love, Christian Bale, for his ability to not be Christian Bale on the screen. Another actor, Bradley Cooper, has the absolute opposite effect on me when I go and see a film of him. I think he's Bradley Cooper playing. How successful a pairing is this?
Well, those two are the most antagonistic characters, and they're both rivals as well for Amy Adams's character. I like them both in it, but actually Christian Bale is the one who's sort of doing more cosmetic stuff to himself, and I was slightly distracted by all of his kind of comb-over antics and all of that. There's sort of a bit more there. Bradley Cooper has this kind of ridiculous perm in it, which is also a bit distracting. I think, in fact, the hair is a bit over the top throughout this film. Listening to that clip, you hear all those bits of voiceover, and the thing that it makes me immediately think of is Martin Scorsese. It's sort of Goodfellas, it's Casino. It's those films in which, you know, we tell a kind of true life crime saga and everyone chips in and explains, now this was happening and then this was the year when this happened. And different characters get a turn to do that. It's a little bit kind of Scorsese karaoke, this film, I think. David O. Russell has definitely taken Scorsese's kind of template and gone off and run with it. And the weakness, I would say, is the story, because when I watch a con movie, I want an incredible sleight of hand to be pulled off. I want something really sophisticated and ingenious, and I want to never know what's coming. And in this film, I think probably because it's slightly bogged down with the actual specifics of the real life story, it's never quite that satisfying. So what you're left with is very entertaining kind of role play, basically. It's like all the actors kind of digging into the dress-up box and seeing what they can come up with. And some of them are
and
hilarious.
The dress-up box seems to be a fun 1970s one, though.
It really is, yeah. And I mean, there are some sort of fantastic costumes, and you've never seen Amy Adams sort of slinking around wearing quite so little as she does in this. Jennifer Lawrence, even though she's meant to be playing a kind of whingy single mother, and she's sort of miscast. I mean, she's about 10 years too young for the role. She's still, it's impossible to take your eyes off her because she's just going for it.
It has touches of Boogie Nights about it. Seedy, but sexy too. I mean, would you agree with that?
A little bit of that, yeah, absolutely. I think that Paul Thomas Anderson as a director has more visual flair than David O. Russell, and he's falling back a bit too much on the kind of Scorsese tricks here. But what his films do have, and what runs through them all, is there's a certain kind of comic energy, quite an angry comic energy between the actors, which is quite distinctive and which you kind of recognise as his. And this film does have that. I preferred The Fighter, I must say. I thought that was the best of his three recent ones. But
let's move on, finally, to The Missing Picture, a film which is unlike the two that we have reviewed. In fact, unlike any film that we've ever reviewed.
Yes, it probably is. I can't find much common ground between that and All Is Lost or American Hustle.
Explain the premise.
It's a sort of a documentary come memoir about a man who suffered an awful lot under the Khmer Rouge. Mm. And he tells the story of this suffering and the various things that happened to his family, not in any kind of conventional way, but using miniatures, little clay figurines that he has sculpted and kind of presented to us in these tableaus. So he shows us the kind of situations that were going on in the villages when the Khmer Rouge were in charge, and the kind of terrible stuff that happened. And meanwhile, we get his voiceover over the top, which is quite a poetic and kind of and very profound kind of meditation on this suffering.
Let's have a listen.
For many years, I have been looking for the missing picture, a photograph taken between 1975 and 1979 by the Khmer Rouge when they ruled over Cambodia. On its own, of course, an image cannot prove mass murder, but it gives us cause for thought, prompts us to meditate, to record history.
Toby, that sounds so gentle.
It is. It's a strangely gentle film. I think poetic is the word I would use. And obviously it's very harrowing, the background to this story, and everything that he relates that happened to his family is kind of ghastly. But there's a distance to it because he's reflecting with this gap of 30 years over what's happened to his past and everything that he's kind of learned and grown to accept since then. And using the figurines as a further way of kind of both distancing us but also reminding us at the same time. It's a really interesting device and quite unique.
Well, I was going to say, I think it is, you know, you can do a very serious, harrowing documentary about it, but when you mix medium like this with archive film footage and these very naive clay animated figurines, I think it draws into relief in a different way, makes you think about what really went happen in a really thought-provoking way.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the only danger, I suppose, is that it might be slightly lulling and a little bit too beautiful, and you're sort of like appreciating this beautiful artistry. But actually, what he has done is turned suffering into art in that way that actually can be really kind of deeply affecting in ways that you're not even thinking through at the time. You're kind of absorbing it, and then afterwards it starts to sort of seep in even more. It's really effective, and it's out at the beginning of January, and it seems to me like a good January film to go and see. You know, after the Christmas bloat, go and think about the Khmer Rouge.
Something reflective to end on. Tim Robey, thanks as ever for your time on The Review. Stay with us because we'll be crossing to the United States to get a little bit sentimental.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
It's Saturday, so you must be listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian De Bias.
Well, staying on the topic of film, it's time to turn to one of our Monocle journalists for a dose of opinion. And as it's nearly Christmas this week, we're getting a bit nostalgic.
Here's Monocle's Barrett Austin to talk us through one of his favourite classic seasonal films.
No matter where you find yourself in the world this week, there's a decent chance you'll find some indication that Christmas is just around the corner. In America, all the hullabaloo of the holiday season has reached a fever pitch. Take a drive down Main Street, and you're sure to find the signs of the season. The nativity scene, precariously placed out front of City Hall. Bright lights and cheeky reindeer strung along the way. These, the physical reminders that old Kris Kringle will soon depart from somewhere in the northernmost reaches of Europe. At home, our televisions offer similar proclamations that Christmas is indeed just days away. Cuddly polar bears remind us that it's not Christmas without Coca-Cola, and it seems every high-spending car brand considers its own rolling stock the perfect holiday gift. In spite of all this, it's the classic Christmas films that really get me into the spirit. A personal favorite is Bob Clark's 1983 A Christmas Story, a cult hit based on the memoirs of American humorist Gene Shepard. Told from the perspective of young Ralphie, a typical adolescent growing up in a perfectly imperfect household, the film offers an honest look at ideas of youth and the challenges of family dynamics, all set around the holiday season. Looking out from his broad, horn-rimmed glasses, the blonde-haired Ralphie fumbles through the wistful trials of youth, all seen from the perspective of a not-so-popular, yet deeply wise young man. In an early scene, little Ralphie finds himself in the lap of an overworked and very possibly over-imbibed Santa Claus, who refuses to hear his request for a Red Ryder 200-shot carbine action BB gun.
If Higby thinks I'm working 1 minute past 9, he can kiss my foot. A football? Oh, no! Okay, what was I doing? Wake up, stupid! Wake up! No!
No, no, I want an official red under cover knife to interject with my leg rifle!
You'll shoot your eye out, kid. Merry Christmas.
The fact that Santa eventually kicks Ralphie down a slide in a clear dismissal of his holiday wants is only part of Ralphie's troubles. Elsewhere in the film, Ralphie faces down bullies like yellow-eyed Scut Farkas, finds himself fleeing a schoolyard scene after a classmate's tongue gets stuck to an icy lamppost, and observes his irritable father and frenzied mother as they go about their lives in suburban Indiana.
You're full of beans and so's your old man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah!
Says who?
Says me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah!
I double dare you.
The exact exchange and nuance of phrase in this ritual is very important.
Are you kidding? Stick my tongue to that stupid pole, that's dumb.
That's cause you know it'll stick.
You're full of it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah!
Like double dog dare ya!
Now it was serious. A double dog dare.
Pink bunny suits, a tacky lamp resembling a woman's leg, and an appalling dinner in an uncharming Chinese restaurant all have their place somewhere in the film. Apart from this bounty of childish humor, it's the spot-on appraisal of the challenges and joys of youth and the life that follows that keeps me coming back for more. As the next week rolls by and the mistletoe comes out from the pantry, I'll surely find myself catching at least one airing of this holiday classic, a feat not especially difficult as one particular American network broadcast it 24 hours straight this time of year. A film such as this, replete with absurd humor, rich in dying Americana, and firmly centered around the Christmas season, is the perfect antidote to the frenetic nature of the modern holiday season. For Monocle, I'm Barrett Austin.
Thanks, Barrett. And if you're in the US, it's pretty much guaranteed that Bob Clark's A Christmas Story will be playing on cable channels near to you.
And time now for our final music reviewer of the year. And this time we're turning the tables. Usually this man is the one bringing in the guests, but we have today Monocle's in-house musical maestro, Paul Noble, this side of the glass and in studio.
Paul, welcome. Welcome
what,
home.
What an honour. I thought you'd never ask.
You've been trying, what, 2 years to try and get to do this?
Eventually I made it on.
What was it that made us buckle?
It was the £100, wasn't it?
No.
Whoops. No, I thought it was about time. Every year, every week I sit there, because I usually listen to this at home,
yeah.
And I sit there and, you know, I will have booked the guest and have an idea of what they're going to talk about. And I thought it was about time I came on and picked...
Do a bit of fair share of shouting at the radio,
exactly.
I suspect. Going, Tobias Nelson, you're not doing the job properly. So, you obviously are massively, massively into your music and so deeply, deeply involved in the music scene globally. When we do ask people, you know, has this been a good year? You will know more than others. So has this been a good year for music?
I mean, not for everything apart from pop music. Yes, right. It's been a great year. The state of the charts, even though it's not something we really touch at Monocle, has just been abysmal. It's turned into this really homogenous, auto-tuned mush with, 10 people all appearing on each other's records. But that's pop music. Outside of that, there's been some fantastic music. The real shock of the year was Lorde in the States, who was number one, I can't even, for something like 7 or 8 weeks with this track called Royals, which is a very stripped down, anti-materialistic R&B. And she's 17 years old. She's from New Zealand. No one saw it coming.
But it's part of the reason that did so well is because people are dying for a bit of a new sound.
Yeah.
You know, craving it.
It was just a bit of an antidote. And then there were some great album releases. One which we talked about here on Monocle was Immunity by John Hopkins, who started off as a ambient, you know, very, very backgroundy electronic producer. Brian Eno picked him up and said, we should work together. And they did a Coldplay album a couple of albums ago. And since then, he's gone on to do live shows. He's done about 4 soundtracks. And he released an album this year, which was a very ambitious, almost concept album in electronica, where he sort of tracked the course of a night out, and that's winning prizes all over the place. And one of the other picks, which I wouldn't play today because it's a bit slow and intense, but a band called These New Puritans did an album called Field of Reeds, which is, you know, the phrase being thrown around is post-rock.
What is post-rock?
Post-rock is kind of all the angst and emotion of rock, but no guitars, no drums. It's a more orchestral arrangement. Talk Talk is the comparison which people keep making. And it's just a lovely set of songs.
You mentioned orchestral. I mean, there has been quite a large return to that kind of sound this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, when you run out of ideas, stick some strings on it. Everyone's with it.
I mean, I've always thought that. I mean, is that true?
I don't know. I mean, you know, you see bands when they get to their third album, they're like, right, what do we do? Do we drop everything?
Cast Against Type.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you see quite a lot of revivals when a band has been away for about 10 years. It decides that it pretends to be grown up and it adds a few strings. It's quite sad.
Yeah, or they'll call him Rick Rubin and say, we want to do something stripped down.
You mentioned a great gig there this year. Who impressed you live?
Who impressed me live? The London Jazz Festival, I saw an outstanding gig, which was Bob James, a famous jazz keyboard player who's kind of known for his heavily sampled funk work. He had a super group of him, David Sanborn, and Steve Gadd, who is one of the great drummers, played with Paul Simon and James Taylor and all sorts of people. And that was just one of those nights where you are in, you know, it was a one-off. It could never happen again. The poor bass player, who was very good, just not a household name like the others. One of the other gigs of my year was Phosphorescent, who I'm one of my picks for later on, who played an incredible show at the Green Man Festival in Wales this year. That was a real moment for me.
Well, the wonderful thing having you in-house is you can just spin your Rolodex and, you know, it stops and you can invite in a guest for either our show, The Review, or the Midori House Sessions. And I think one of the highlights this year was Casey Musgrove, who is one of your picks today.
Yeah, Casey Musgrove, she's 25. You will not be surprised to hear she's from Texas. It's definitely, we could call it Mueller-approved music.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is a reference to much beloved of this parish, Andrew Mueller,
who has
very strong ideas about how music should be played. It doesn't always complement what anybody else on this earth thinks. But Casey Musgrove was an astonishing woman who just was stratospheric with her rise this year.
Yeah, we got her at a very good time. She finished this TV show called Nashville Star. She only came seventh. It's a reality show in the States. But since then, put out this album called Same Trailer, Different Park, which kind of gives you an idea of the country and Western territory we're in. And she came in for a session and just absolutely spellbound the whole audience.
Let's have a listen to Casey Musgrove. This is Merry Go Round.
You ain't got two kids by 21, you're probably gonna die alone. At least that's what tradition told you. And it don't matter if you don't believe, come Sunday morning, you best be there in the front row like you're supposed to. Same hurt in every heart, same trailer, different.
Intelligent and sensitive sounding Casey Musgrove there, and Merry Go Round, one of the choices of Paul Noble. We know him very, very well here at Monocle 24. We're introducing him finally to the listener. Paul, you wanted to move on from one girl who has a very strong identity, Casey Musgrove, to another one, Janelle Monáe.
Yeah, Janelle Monáe. Even if you haven't heard her, you've probably seen her. She's got a very distinctive look. She's always in black and white.
The hair is astonishing.
Great quiff, very petite. And she's part of the... She came out via the Outkast team, so Andre 3000 and Big Boy from Atlanta, doing this kind of futuristic R&B. And her first album was called Arch Android. The press went nuts for it. I couldn't get into it. I thought there was one good tune on it called Sincerely Jane, which sounded like a fantastic Bond theme. The rest of it was just really, the melodies weren't doing it for me.
Her felt second quite album, empty when you heard it.
It was just, you know, I'm a robot and I'm from the future and I'm an alien and we've been there before. But this current album called Electric Lady is phenomenal, and she's really just focused on the songwriting. She's collaborated with kind of all my favourite artists at the moment. So there's Prince and Erykah Badu and Miguel and the fantastic Esperanza Spalding, who we've played quite a lot on the station.
We like
as well.
A lot here on Monocle's.
We do. And yeah, the whole album is really strong. So I picked one of the tracks with Solange Knowles, Beyonce's sister, the hipster Knowles. And yeah, this is it.
And here it is. Janelle Monáe there. The track was called Electric Lady from her second studio album, The Electric Lady. The choice of our music reviewer, Paul Noble, today on The Review. And also, we've just heard a bit of a knee trembler for our studio manager, Chris Grimes.
Yeah, who knew?
It all came out while we were listening to that, ladies and gentlemen. It was quite something. Paul, you have a final choice for us. You mentioned Phosphorescent about 5 or 10 minutes ago. Tell us why you've chosen them.
Phosphorescent is one guy called Matthew Hook. He's from Athens, Georgia, which is REM territory, so we're already in a sort of deeply melodic album land. This is his seventh album. It's called Muchacho. It came out right at the beginning of the year, almost at the start of January, so I'm glad I could sneak it onto my end of year list. It's just the whole album is strong, but this song is called Song for Zula, and I'm amazed no one's put it on an ad or a film yet, because it's just one of those epic, heartbreaking songs.
What would happen to him if it were to go onto an ad?
He'd make loads of money.
Fine. Let's have a listen to Phosphorescent, Song for Zula.
Some say love is a burning thing, that it makes the fire ring. Oh, but I know love as a fading thing, just as fickle as a feather in a stream. See, honey, I saw love. You see, it came to me. It put its face up to my face so I could see. Yeah, then I saw love disfigure me into something I am not recognizing.
Phosphorescent there and Song for Zula, the choice of Paul Noble. Paul, what's that's a lovely downtempo, has melancholy
gorgeous.
To it.
It is, isn't it? It's
what's
a hot, heartbreaker.
What's the rest of the album like?
This is probably the slowest and mellowest one of the album. The rest of it gets us a bit more rocky, but it's his voice really carries it. As we were saying, there's a bit of Dylan, a bit of Bowie, some Springsteen. It's just that sort of agonising, tortured sound.
It's well careworn, that's for
it
sure.
It is.
We have time just to squeeze in one more track. So before we say goodbye to you, introduce us to Step Kids, please.
Step Kids are the coolest. They're from Connecticut. They're originally session musicians who used to play with Alicia Keys and Stevie Wonder, and took the fairly brave gamble of saying, you know what, we could just travel around the world backing up artists, or we could go and do it ourselves. This is their second album. It's on a label called Stone's Throw, which is one of my favourites. They're always putting out very forward-thinking funk, and they're tapping into the kind of yacht rock Doobie Brothers, sort of blue-eyed...
Yacht rock,
yes.
That's something I've missed.
Where have you been?
Not on a yacht, clearly.
Yacht rock would be sort of funky soul music, which you could listen to while wearing a white sailor's cap.
Fantastic.
Doobie Brothers, Michael McDonald.
That's 2014 sorted for me immediately. Paul Noble, I'm afraid we have to say goodbye to you. And thank you very much indeed for bringing all the wonderful guests and curating all the music for us. Thank you, Paul. This is Step Kids and Desert in the Dark.
I remember you in the photo booth. Push the button down.
That was Step Kids, Desert in the or Desert in the Dark. It was actually written as Desert in the Dark as well, which is something else. That was a song by the American psychedelic soul band, The Step Kids, from their second album, Troubadour, and the final choice of Paul Noble, today's music review.
Well, it's cold here in the UK, but in the summer, southern hemisphere, summer is in full swing, and Christmas is not just about wrapping up warm in the snow. Here's our Buenos Aires correspondent, Ed Stocker, to talk us through what's coming up in the city over the coming days.
The Christmas holidays are upon Buenos Aires, and this means heat waves, power cuts, and a soon-to-commence exodus to the coast in January. But the commercial fanfare of Christmas is refreshingly low-key here, and the cultural calendar continues unabated. No one wants to be stuck indoors, so my Saturday plan is to head to the Bosques de Palermo, the city's most spectacular park, for an afternoon of live music beginning from 3 p.m. I'm looking out for a local outfit called El Kelye, a band that mixes everything from acoustic guitar to Latin hip-hop, and doesn't take itself too seriously. At night, I'll head to the nearby Recoleta neighbourhood and the ever-excellent Malba Art Gallery. They have a late-night cinema that will be showing a classic from the cult American director David Lynch, 1997 psychological thriller Lost Highway. The screening starts at midnight. Sunday will start in leisurely fashion with a midday visit to Souvenir in the Saavedra neighbourhood, a collectibles fair on until Monday. I'm hoping to pick up one or two last-minute Christmas presents and then tuck into a nibble on offer in the beautiful garden, as well as a refreshing drink. Re-energised and with the Christmas panic at bay, I'll hop in a taxi and head south to La Boca and Proa. The Art Foundation is showing the first South American exhibition by Australian hyper-realist sculptor Ron Weck, who focuses on the human anatomy. And if you don't have time to catch today, worry not, because the exhibition is on until March before continuing to Brazil. Finally, I plan on a bit of pure entertainment in the evening at Recoleta's Cultural Centre in the form of Fuerza Bruta at 9 p.m.
Walking into someone's dream and you could see everything, everyone was fighting against time and they couldn't help it.
The show, a mixture of art, music and theatre, is almost impossible to explain unless you see it. On the road for the last 2 years, taking in cities such as London, New York and Moscow, the spectacle is back in its hometown. And what better way to round off the weekend? For Monaco in Buenos Aires, I'm Ed Stocker.
And you're listening to The Review, thanks Ed, on Monocle 24. We'll be back next to hear about two very different books on modern Israel, which have been keeping our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent glued to the page.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Welcome back. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review with Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
Now, books and what we make of them are a regular feature on this programme. And today we're taking a slightly different approach. We've been asking our Monocle friends and colleagues to share what they've been reading with us. And here's our correspondent, Joe Sedena, to talk us through the titles stacked up on his bedside table.
Hi, I'm Joseph Dana, Eastern Mediterranean correspondent for Monocle, and I've just moved to Istanbul from Jerusalem, so it's probably no surprise that on my bedside table I have a number of volumes, recent volumes, about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and how that kind of sits in the greater picture of the Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East. And two volumes in particular I've found really, really interesting this kind of holiday season. One is by the American journalist Max Blumenthal. It's called Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And the other volume, the almost kind of polar opposite of this picture, is by the Israeli journalist Ari Shavit. And it's called My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. We discuss this conflict all the time. I mean, it's almost to a point now where we're just kind of exhausted of it. And so these two books are kind of personal reflections from completely different vantage points on where Israel's headed, how did the Palestinians play into that picture, and whether or not we're actually at a turning point in the debate. Now, Ari Shavit's book, coming from this kind of very elite Israeli background that Ari Shavit has, is a kind of standard liberal take on Israeli society. Yes, there's a lot of problems in Israel. Yes, we can't avoid the news that's coming out of Israel. But ultimately, this is a very triumphant country. It's a country that stood up against the odds. I mean, we've heard this kind of debate a lot in the past. Now, Max Blumenthal's book is also written from a Jewish perspective. Max himself is this Jewish American journalist, but it doesn't take any prisoners, as it were. It's written in this really bombastic, almost jingoistic kind of language, and it's an angry book. I mean, the anger of it is kind of shocking. And so I actually have a small sentence in which he introduces the Israeli foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who's no stranger to controversy, but he says, "On a sunny day in 1999, a hulking bear-like man with a close-cropped salt-and-pepper beard that outlined a pudgy face and beady, darting eyes lumbered through the quiet residential streets of Nokdim, a Jewish settlement in the occupied West Bank." And so Avigdor Lieberman is a very controversial guy, and he says a lot of very almost absurd things in public forums. But, you know, this language of a pudgy face and beady, darting eyes, it just seems so forced. And so I had some problems trying to get to the root of what he was saying. But from another perspective, I think it's incredibly interesting that this kind of book can come out about Israel in the United States and in the English-speaking world. And so from that vantage point, it's not even the arguments that they're making. It's just the fact that they're discussing the country in this way, which is so interesting. If you take both of them together, you see that there is a certain debate that is changing. There's a certain avenue that's been opened in the Israeli-Palestinian discourse to allow for some new kind of thinking. And I think that's a really positive development in at least the coverage of the conflict.
Thanks to Joseph Dana for that. Ari Shavit's book, My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel, is published by Scribe. And Max Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, is out now too, published by Nation Books.
Well, there's not long now to go until Christmas, so if you're having a last-minute panic about what gifts to buy, look no further. All this week on The Globalist, our writer Josh Fenart has been sharing his Christmas gift guide with producer Ala John. You can find the full list in the current issue of Monocle magazine, but here's a selection of the best gifts from this week's guide for you to enjoy.
Christmas, Christmas, Christmas. Merry Christmas time. Joshua, you're going to run us through some of the delights from the Monocle Christmas guide, is that correct?
My first selection on this first day for children is some wooden Skittles.
Chigo Skittles?
They're a Japanese firm. I think they were set up in 2005. Monocle have actually done a collaboration with them. We made some lovely wooden blocks. Skittles are the sort of thing. I mean, they're made of wood. There's a certain honesty to it. And we're all about the analogue. We're not about the computer games and stuff. So, you know, a nice wooden Skittle set. You can enjoy that with the kids, the nieces, the nephews.
Yeah, it's sort of family fun.
I think so.
Third on the list, Ichiro Design Coloro Wagon.
Yeah, I mean,
I should really leave the pronouncing to you.
Well, that's okay. I quite enjoy you doing it. this is something that I think was released at Maison et Objet this year.
Which you went to?
Which I did go to. Yeah, with our design editor Tom Morris and our contributing editor Alicia. There was a kind of merry band of us there, and this sort of caught my eye. Every Christmas haul needs a bit of haulage, and it's a stacked wagon made of wood, and you can take off each layer of the wagon, and it forms a sort of basket which you can put your Christmas goodies in, or the handles fold down and it can become a kind of side table or whatever. It's a practical item. It's very charming.
Versatile.
Very versatile, yeah, and it looks good on the page, which you've always got to think about.
Christmas. Take me through. What have we got next?
Next up, we've got a rather nice cocktail set. I mean, it doesn't sound like the most insightful gift, but it's a particularly well-made one. It's made by a company called Tubo, who are, I think it's an American guy, and the company's based in Japan, using a lot of the kind of traditional Japanese craftsmanship, which is involved in glassmaking.
We're very big fans of that.
Yeah, of course. Well, anyone that takes time and effort to put a product together has our attention, and if the product looks nice, like this one, then, you know, all the better for it. So there's a cocktail shaker, there's a thing for measuring out shots or doubling up if you have an unbearable Christmas with family, you feel you need to get through.
Yeah, very handsome glassware it is. It's got the diamond pattern at the base of the glass as well as on the cocktail shaker itself.
Wouldn't look out of place on a nice teak bureau.
It wouldn't at all. I mean, I don't have one of them myself, but I can imagine.
Me neither, but that's next Christmas.
Yeah, okay. And finally, Josh, the final item on our list for today's edition of the Christmas wish list.
The final item is a shoe polishing set, a particularly nice shoe polishing set from our good friends just down the road from Monocle HQ at Trunk Clothiers. They actually lent us this. It's something they stock in the shop. So if you're in London, I suggest you pop by and grab one. Alden are a very old shoe company based in Middlesbrough, Massachusetts, which I imagine is just as glamorous as Middlesbrough here in the UK.
I was going to say, yeah.
It was founded in 1884 by Charles H. Alden, and let's just say the man knew a thing or two about boots.
You and I were just talking before we came on air about how important it is to buffer our shoes, spit and polish.
I was almost blinded, actually, when I came down the stairs behind you here at Midori House to see the kind of shine you've got on those shoes.
They're very shiny, I have to say. I haven't actually used the polish, but maybe I've got a polishing kit in my Christmas stocking, Josh, do I?
We'll see, Alan. We'll see.
Carrying on. So, Florist Perfume.
It's part of the establishment in London. I think they're by appointment to Her Majesty, who, as we all know, is an excellent contemporary taste in perfume.
Does she?
Well, it's by appointment to her. I'm never quite sure what that means. I don't, that's what it says in a Waitrose bag. But this particular company was founded in the early 18th century. It's based here in London. And the one I've picked, the Amaryllis Perfume, has sort of lower notes of frankincense and myrrh. Don't ask me what either of these are. It's in a gold bottle, so there's
very
a kind
Christmassy,
of,
though, that's
very Christmassy. There's sort of the kingly gift of those three presents.
Interesting.
As we recall, it's kind of a nice touch, and it's a very nice perfume. And I think the bottle was actually taken home by our very own foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield,
who really
gifted it to a very special lady in his life, his aunt. So
great stuff.
I'm pleased that was able to bring some Christmas joy.
Well, she hasn't opened it yet. She might not like it.
She might.
Maison Constantin chocolates. Okay.
Okay, so,
not a Valentine's Day thing. This is a Christmas thing. Tell me why.
Well, everyone likes chocolates. Everyone likes a nice little treat. And these are some particularly nice ones. I think our associate art director, Emma Chu, actually found these guys. So they're founded in 1923, Maison Constantin, a French patisserie, who sort of branched out into doing all sorts of delightful comestibles, and they've got some beautifully kind of packaged chocolates, some meal for you, which is kind of a, like a layered cake style sweets.
A thousand layers.
A thousand layers, exactly, for the polyglots among you. And yeah, they're just a beautiful, beautiful set of chocolates. Very nice. And, you know, I'd be happy to find them in the end of my stocking.
Oh, yeah, a very charming present. One that you might be able to give to a whole family, say, to enjoy at the end of the meal.
Absolutely. They say that an Englishman's home is his castle. And if you're looking to brighten up that castle, the first thing on our winter wish list is...
Not electric lights.
Not electric lights, no. We're a fan of the dull glow of a nice candle here at Monocle. And I've picked out some nice Minimalux candle holders. The recommendation actually came from our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell.
He likes a good candle.
He loves a good candle. There's nothing he loves more. And these are quite nice bits of kit. They're made of very kind of mirrored, polished brass, and they also come in copper. They're very minimalistic, and the company's actually called Minimalux, so they're kind of acknowledging it in the title.
I've got it. It looks kind of like the end of a trombone. not the end where the sound comes out, but one of the tubular ends. It's kind of the curve.
It looks a little like that. So for people that can't see it, it looks sort of a bit like the letter U. And then when you hold
exactly
it, they're very sturdy, they're very nice, and... kind of shiny and just kind of interesting bits of kit. I think they'd look great. I think anyone would be happy to have them for Christmas. If you'll allow me, it's not strictly for the home, but there's nothing as Christmassy as seeing a robin redbreast in the garden. And if you do want to...
I mean, it's not Christmas tree, it's not presents, it's the robin redbreast for
if
you.
It's part of it. And I think if you feel good towards your avian friends, you could buy them a lovely bird feeder from this New York-based company. They have a brilliant selection of homeware, everything from sort of outdoors stuff to stuff for inside the house. But this copper bird feeder, I think it's on the third spread of the Christmas gift guide in the current issue, and it has a Samsung phone sitting inside it, but...
not the conventional fare for a young robin.
Not the conventional fare for a young robin, but it's a really nice addition to the outside, so if you know someone that's a keen horticulturalist, or if you are yourself, I suggest investing in one.
So this is one of my favourite categories, I'd say, and probably the most favourite, although it does remind me of my dear departed dog. This is for pets.
What was his name?
Her name was Reg.
We'll make this for...
Reg.
Bit of a confusing name, bit of gender confusion there in the John household. The first thing I kind of like the look of is a very nice dog lead. There's a bit of a joke in the name. It's called the Houndstooth Dog Lead, which is a particular type of weave.
Good.
And they're just extraordinarily strong. I think the buckle on them is able to handle 1,000 pounds of pressure.
Ooh, that's a big dog.
Well, hell of a dog. That's a courser. A car.
You're looking at that. That's like a lion. It's a lion's leash.
But you know, I like that kind of backup. I mean, I don't personally have a dog, but my sister, she's got two huskies, Alad.
Whoa.
They take some serious controlling. She has to wear a harness to walk them.
Mush.
It's a real problem. It's
mush
real
is the problem. Word. Or not the word you want. But you could say mush when you've got this lead in your hands.
That's true.
Take your arm off. But.
they'll try. But it's an LA-based manufacturer, and it's just a great little bit of kit.
Mush indeed. That was Josh Fennett and Alad John talking about this year's Christmas gift guide, which you can find in the current issue of Monocle magazine. It is absolutely beautiful. Although, Josh, I hate to say it, you try and tear a child away from an iPad with some Skittles, you've got a bit of a fight on your hand. With that, I'm afraid we have to bring to a close our weekly review show, The Last Before Christmas. So goodbye from us here at Midori House. Thank you very much for listening, and good luck with your last minute gift buying and your cultural pursuits over Christmas. Our thanks to our producer Katie Bilboa and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and to Chris Grimes, our studio manager too.
Next week on The Review, it's a seasonal special, a best of show looking back at the highlights from the programme over the past 12 months. But for now, get ready for the curator Monocle's best of radio show, which pulls together the unmissable highlights from the week that was here on Monocle 24.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias. Have a great weekend and Merry Christmas.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. Its dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.